Hi, welcome back to a new episode of Shut Your Face. Yes, I have kind of changed some things around, but it's still just as cool. Anyhow, if you're not a member of our Patreon, what are you doing? It's really cool. So head over there and become a member so you can get early access. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast, and let us begin.
Hello. Hey, is this Kelly?
It is.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. You're on the way to a horse show, right?
I am, yes.
How cool is that?
Yes, it is. We're 45 minutes behind time because the horses decided today was not the day that they wanted to remember how to load.
Well, let me go ahead and just dive on into this. So, were you raised around horses? When you were young, or did you get into them as later on in life?
Oh yeah, I was raised with horses. My mom came from a horse family. Her parents came from a horse family. There's horses as far back as we know.
And did they show, or did they do? Did they reining?
So they did all kinds of things. My great grandma, she was a competitor in the English side of things. And then my grandpa, he did more of like the all around AQHA stuff. And he wanted to get into reining, but just didn't. And then growing up, I did like just more on the open level show circuit. And really more on the Arabian side of things. And then when I left for college, my mom always showed with me as well, but when I left for college, my mom got heavily into barrel racing and then traveled very competitively in barrel racing. And after I got married and everything, I decided that I wanted to get back into horses. And I came across reining, and that's how I ended up getting into reining. And then my mom switched over to reining with me as well.
How can you go from Arab to reining to barrel to reining? That's kind of cool, though.
Yeah, it definitely gives you a wide range of horse personalities, to say the least.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, all of it. I mean, barrel racing is really competitive. Reining's, I mean, all of it's really competitive. But that's really cool, though, but I don't think a lot of people know that Arabians are actually, like, one of the first, I don't want to say American quarter horse, but actually I think an Arabian was the first registered American quarter horse, but everybody knows it from like the other ones that were more, I'm going to have to Google this because I'm more than positive I'm right. I'm just might be missing some spots on it, but Arabs are a big deal. I think I just saw a thing on TikTok where like this first ever in history, a mare won like 3-time champion or something. And it was like a big ordeal.
Yeah, my mom was, like, very, very accomplished with her Arabians. Like, she was a very heavy competitor, world champion, and then she scaled back when she had me and my brother and then kind of started all over, and we just brought up horses, and that's what we ended up showing for a long time.
Yes, right here. It's right. In 1752, John Randolph of Virginia imported a grandson of the God Dolphin Arabian called Janus, and when Janus was born, I might be saying that wrong, J-A-N-U-S, was bred to colonial mares bearing the blood of the Chickasaw horse. The first result was the prototype of the American quarter horse. A lot of people don't know that.
Wow. I didn't know that either.
Yeah, I happened to run across this like a couple of years ago during COVID when people were posting like, did you know horse facts or something like that? And everybody was calling her crazy, but she was right. And that's what she was talking about, like Arabians being one of the first AQHA or whatever. But anyways, back to you and reining. Now, you opened Home and Farms Realty, correct? That's your baby.
Yes, that's my company.
Okay, that's what I thought. And then because I do work for Sydney. I did work for you, obviously, but you guys work together. But this is your company, and then you've got agents that work for you, which is really cool.
Yes. Sydney's one of my top agents.
And what made you decide to go into real estate preferably around horse farms.
My love for horses and just the love for the horse farm and really understanding it and being in real estate. So when I got into real estate, it's because I came off of owning a bunch of restaurants, and I knew I needed to do something different. And after I sold the restaurants, I had always wanted to do real estate. So I got into real estate, and quickly, probably a few months into real estate, I really realized that agents were selling horse farms that really had no idea what they were doing. They were just guessing, and they were treating it like regular residential real estate. So I decided to brand myself as Home and Farms at that point. And so from the beginning, even as a solo agent, I branded myself as a Home and Farms expert. And then I created a team off of that in a larger franchise, like underneath another broker. I started a team. But then as I started expanding and going into multiple states and multiple areas, even in the large franchise brokerages, they're all independently owned. So I was coming across problems of not being able to access the MLSs. So that's where I ended up deciding that I was going to join a cloud-based brokerage. Well, that ended up getting a little bit more complex with the team, and it just made sense for us to branch off and for me to start my own brokerage and have my team underneath that, so that we can have more flexibility on where we operated and how we operated. But mainly because the reason why I started all of this is because I have put together a group of extremely knowledgeable agents that know how to understand and speak the language of selling horse farms and what makes something more valuable or less valuable than the next, and really understanding how to price options out, you know, from the different land to the fencing to the barns to the stalls to the arenas. And it's just a niche that is not, well, at the time when I started it, really wasn't anybody focused on. Now there's definitely more agents that do focus on it a little bit, but there's not like a national brand that focuses mm-hmm. on it. And that's where Home and Farms really comes in. We're in 4 states, but we are working on growing nationwide so that we are a national brand specifically for people who are looking to buy and sell horse farms.
Yeah, you are right because if you don't know anything about it's hard to even be able to touch on all of that stuff as a real estate agent if you've just not been around horses. I mean, like, you would have to have the experience in order to add that type of value into the real estate industry.
Yeah, and then when you meet with a client, you know, especially a seller or a buyer, and you don't know what you're talking about with horse people, typically horse people can see right through it. I mean, we're really trained to operate off of body language. So it's easy for us to pick up when somebody is faking it, right? It's like mm-hmm. pretending to know what they're talking about but not, and it makes sellers feel uncomfortable when, you know, they have a multi-million-dollar facility that they need to sell, and somebody shows up in a puffle skirt and stiletto heels, and they're like, "Oh yes, I love your stall. It's so beautiful." And they're meaning barn or stable or whatever, and they just are trying to fake it. You know, it just leaves a bad taste. Even though that person might be good at selling luxury, there's a lot more involved with that, even on our luxury farms, with selling property like that, understanding it and being able to really market it and speak the terms to potential buyers.
Yeah, it's just like that. I always felt like that, what do they call it, farmhouse aesthetic, the white farmhouse aesthetic. I'm thinking that's not a farmhouse, but okay.
Right, put some dog prints on there and a little bit of mud, and
you're gonna need a lot of dirt.
A lot of dirt. A little bit of dust on the table.
That is really good, though. And I think that, I mean, obviously that's a good business idea to be able to hit on a niche that's needed. I mean, that's the whole point of business, is being able to solve a problem. And, you know,
right.
do you
that's
think it. That your... Do you think that your business has grown based off the idea of people, just non-horse people, wanting to be horse people, or do you think it was already missing prior to the hype that the general public got off of horses? Because that's kind of risen over the last couple of years. You know, before, because I was around in the real estate industry before, and you, I mean, I don't want to say horse farms were overlooked, but they were. Like, nobody really...
Yeah.
You didn't have people that specifically focused on horse farms like you guys do.
Right.
So
right.
it was still overlooked. And then now it's like a thing. Do you think yeah. you've kind of felt that?
So I think more of we created it. Or, you know, I don't know that it was so much that they were overlooked. It's that they were undermarketed. And what happens is that you've got a person who's got an indoor arena or barn or whatever, and they need to sell it. They call a local realtor. The local realtor is, like, only looking at the house. And they're like, well, gosh, you have, like, a 1,200-square-foot ranch that looks like it hasn't been cleaned in, you know, 7 years. And they're not looking at the $3 million barn that's sitting outside, right? Like, they don't know how to
right.
decode that. Or nobody was trained like that for a long time. So they get in there and they tell the sellers, well, I know you built this and put a lot of money into here, but we just can't sell it for any more than what we could bring in for your house. You basically have to give your barn away. And I think for a long time, that's what a lot of people were thought to believe and taught, until you got experts like me that came into the market. And I started really focusing on this and started Home and Farms like 15 years ago. So when you come in and you're like, wait, don't listen to what that regular agent has to say. Listen to me, and then let me market it to people who actually would come into this area to buy it, because this is the market value, and usually the market value on a structure like that is going to be less than what it costs to build it. So we can target and attract people in, but you need to do the right marketing behind it. So, and I do think, obviously, with, like, Yellowstone and everything, the horse craze thing definitely has picked up, and there's a lot of people out there that are like, oh, I want a big old ranch, until they get one, and then they call me, and they're like, oh, we need to sell this, because they didn't realize they needed a full-time, you know, lawn crew to take care of everything. But, I mean, I do think that helps with it, and understanding and putting, like, horse people on the map a little bit. But I think a lot of the horse properties just were really under-marketed and underserved by people hiring inadequate real estate agents.
Yeah, because you're right. They don't focus on the amenities that come with having a ranch, like what you said. Like,
oh, yeah.
the money that it takes to build some of those barns and
the
extra things, wash pits and the way the gates are made, and the, like you said, indoor-outdoor arena. They don't teach that in real estate school.
They don't really teach anything in real estate school except for a bunch of stuff that you don't really need to know.
Right. Well, did you have to get licensed into each state?
Yes.
Well, hold on. Let me back up. You're in Tennessee, Georgia, Kentucky, and Florida?
Not yet. Kentucky and Florida are on our map, but we are in Tennessee, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi. And then I am in the works of adding Florida. We do have a couple agents that are waiting to join, and one agent that is ready to get her Florida license as well. And I just need to finish up the remainder of my Florida course and then sit for my broker exam, and we'll be able to open up a place in Florida as well.
Very cool, because it does. Now, you can get your real estate license fairly quickly, but brokerage actually has to take, like, what, 2 years?
Yeah, 2 or 3 years, I think. And then there's 120 credit hour minimum, and then there is additional coursework afterwards. So, yeah, I had to do all of that. But like I said, I've been doing this for 15 years. So over the course of 15 years, it's not that hard to accumulate the courses. And then you have to sit through an exam in each state, and then you have to do continuing education as well.
Yeah, because, like, North Carolina, like, the actual, just to go get your real estate license, you could do it in a matter of, like, 6 weeks. But to be a brokerage,
oh, yeah.
you have to actually, like, work as an agent for X amount of time before you can, was the way it used to be. I don't know if they changed it or not. So I'm assuming it would be like that in most of the
yeah.
states, but I don't know.
It is. It's still the same way. Actually, I was looking at North Carolina because that's one of the states that we're also adding. And there are some a little bit of difference is when you're already a broker in the neighboring state, if they have a reciprocity agreement, but which means that I can go right in and sit for the exam for North Carolina. Or there's a couple options that I can do because I'm already a broker. And so what the states require is that because I'm a broker, I can't ever drop down as just a real estate agent. I have to always come in as a broker. So I have to do that same level of whatever that particular state requires.
Well, that's still a good thing for you because then you can recruit the agents that are already there. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Definitely. And that's what we're doing. That's how we're growing. And, you know, I'm trying to get hyper-local agents in each community that is knowledgeable in selling and understanding how to market horse farms, but also sells regular properties. I mean, we do have a lot of agents in our brokerage that don't even sell horse farms. They focus on investment homes or lake homes or mountain retreats. We do everything. We have commercial agents that those are what they focus on, and we line people up with the best agent for what they're looking to do.
Well, yes, of course. So now I wanted to get into, I just found out that you show too, which is cool, but you also show, and you only particularly show reiners, right?
Right. That's all that I show is reiners. Yeah, I do. I would love to hate it, but I love it. It's addicting. You know, it's always like you just keep coming back for more and more. But, yeah, I absolutely love it. I did a show. We went to Congress, and then we did a show, I think last weekend or the weekend before that, and I was like, oh, man, I don't want show season to be over. And so then we ended up throwing on one more show that the Dixie Reining Horse Association is throwing on. So we're running over to that to show, which was not on our schedule, but I just had a hard time closing the door for the year.
There's nothing wrong with that.
It's bad addiction.
Well, I mean, you know, well, it's a really good, it's obviously that's your business is horse farm. Right. So it would make sense for you to show horses. Like that's, I mean, if you want to do what bears do, you have to go where bears are. So,
right.
yeah, that's pretty common sense. If you want to sell horse farms, you might want to be around horse people.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Now you also have a daughter, and do you have a granddaughter now?
I do. So I have four children. My oldest daughter is an electrical engineer, and she lives like in the Knoxville region. And then I have a second daughter who sells real estate with me, and she's done that for about 3 years now. And she does have a daughter, so I do have a granddaughter, and she's getting married 2025, which is very exciting. And then I have another daughter who is, I know, it's very exciting.
Tell her to love.
I know, right? Well, we've looked at that, but it's almost just as expensive because we have such a big family. We have to get the plane tickets. And so we have looked at, like, the Wyoming and the Montana eloping packages and stuff like that. So that's definitely been on the table. But I don't know. I think she wants, she wants her daddy to walk her down the aisle and a little bit more of, like, their traditional stuff, you know, to happen.
Yeah.
So whatever she wants is what we'll do.
Those pictures are kind of priceless anyways, like to have that kind of stuff, you know, like it's really cool. I know. Well, I saw that on your page and I was like, that's a lie. There ain't no way. There's no way this girl is a freaking grandmother. There's no way.
It's true. I'm a 29-year-old grandma. I tell everybody.
Well,
and then they start doing the math and they're like, there ain't no way. But then I do have another daughter who is a freshman at college, and then I have the son who is a sophomore in high school. So, and they all were very competitive in the horse world. My second daughter, who has a daughter, she actually made top 10 as a youth in the rating world for a world title. My oldest daughter, she was competitive with hunter jumpers. We had a very nice warm blood that she used to compete on. And my youngest daughter, she showed reining horses for a long time, and so did my son. So everybody in our family really shows.
Oh, cool. It is a family affair. Okay, because for a minute there, I thought maybe that was just you, and you did that. That was kind of your thing. But, oh, so your whole family does it. That's cool.
Yeah. My husband shows with me, too. So, I mean, we're all out there competing with each other, which can make a little bit of a hostile environment sometimes. But we all love each other at the end.
Sydney brought that up about her because, you know, her and her husband show, and he shows, and she said that they were competitive, which I think is really cute. And you guys are the same way? You and your husband are the same way?
Oh, very much. Like, I think, and that's what helps everything with the business, and he's very involved with the business, too. Like, he helps run everything, and, like, he definitely drives me to do better, not just because I want to compete against him, but just because we're constantly always trying to be better at everything that we do, from business to working out to riding horses to just everything that we do. We always try to continue to level up.
Yeah. I mean, what's the point of doing something if you're not going to try to do it right, or at least, you know, seriously, because it's like, I think sometimes people get too caught up in the end product, like, let me step into this and then I got to be perfect. Well, no, it's a process. Yeah. You know, I mean, like, you have to, you can either learn from your mistakes or not. And that's life.
Exactly. That's like the biggest thing is people get so caught up in perfection that they get paralyzed. It's, you know, it's terrible. And like, we were just at a leadership retreat this week and down in Texas, and that's one of the things we were heavily focused on was recruiting. And one of the other big brokerages we were talking with was talking about their recruiting tactics for agents, and they're like, you know, ours is not perfect, but we started. And then every year it gets better and better and better, but if we waited till perfect, we would have never started. And that's just the case with everything. If you wait till perfect, you'll be paralyzed. You won't go forward.
That's very true. That is very, very true. It's funny that we're talking about this, actually, because like, even when it comes to home buy-in, I know some people, like, I feel people say things like, well, I'm going to wait till this rate goes down, or I'm going to wait till this, or I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do that. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, well, you're just going to be waiting forever because,
oh, yeah, 100%.
I mean, like, you know, there's not ever a perfect time to do anything. You just start doing it, which is still scary.
We always say date the rate and marry the house, because it's easier to buy a house when it's easier to buy a house when these rates are higher and then refinance it while you're in the house that you love, than to wait until the rates drop and then compete with very competitive offers, unless you've got deep pockets to be able to pay a bunch of cash out of pocket.
Yeah, that, I don't know, obviously there's a reason why y'all do this for a living and I don't, because I don't know anything when it comes to the whole, like, you know, like, rates. You see all this stuff about, like, mortgage rates and up and down and blah, 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 and, like, all this kind of everything, and it's always been, I've always kind of just looked at it like, all right, well, that's not my, I don't know, let's move over that. But that's funny that you said that, date the rate and marry the house, because you're right, you could refinance.
Yeah. You're better off doing that rather than trying to wait for the rates to drop, because what if your house that you love doesn't come on the market? Or what if it does and you're competing against 15 other offers, which more than likely is going to be the case when these rates drop again?
Very true. Before I forget, though, about your husband, you and your husband being competitive. In the horse world, maybe I'm wrong, but it's always like you have either one or two options when it comes to couples in the horse world. You either have the couple that does it together or the couple that are complete opposites.
I 100% agree with that. There are probably more women that I meet on the road whose husbands are not with them because they're just not into horses and they're doing something completely different. So I agree with that. I feel like it's a lot easier when your husband is into horses, because then they can support it. They support you with it, and they're not always moaning and complaining and, you know, even though they probably still do that, but not to the level of, like, if you've got somebody who's big into, like, hunting or something like that, where you guys are just going in different directions all the time. At least, like, we're going in the same direction. We have the same, like, oh, let's do this, or let's get this horse, or let's breed to this stallion. You know, we're on the same page with a lot of that.
Right. You are, yeah, you're exactly right. It's just funny, because I've always said, like, that's the only thing I meet, too. When you meet somebody like that, they're either by, like what you just said, they're either, the girl is by herself, or the guy is by themselves, and they're exact opposites, or they're there together. Mm-hmm. It's like no in-between.
Yep. There is no in-between. No, I agree. I agree with that. No, it's funny how that works.
Yeah, it is funny how that works. Now, back to what you said. You said that you've been doing this for 15 years. I was under the assumption you just kind of started this, like, in the last 4 or 5 years. So did you do regular real estate initially and then move into horse farms, or did you start out the gate doing horse farms that long ago?
So I pretty much started, I got into it doing regular real estate, yes, because I figured horse farms was just a part of regular real estate. And at the time, I think I was just like maybe a few months in, and I said to my broker, I said, I'm going to focus on horse farms. And he laughed at me and said, this isn't really an area for horse farms. I was in East Tennessee, right? East Tennessee is a major horse farm area. And I'm like, what? I'm like, really? Like, that's your idea behind this? I was like blown away at the thought that he didn't think that East Tennessee was full of horse farms. So, and North Georgia, because it was also in Georgia. So I went ahead and started the brand Home and Farms, started the logo, all of that. Gosh, probably right when I started, within that first year or two of real estate. But I did it as a solo agent, and then I ended up adding 2 agents on my team that worked with me, and they covered more of, like, the regular real estate while I focused more on the horse farms. But, yeah, I mean, Home and Farms, the brand of it has been going strong, I would say, for at least 12 years, if not longer than that, because I started branding it very early in my career.
That's really awesome. That's really good.
Yeah.
Because, it shows kind of how long it takes to do something like that. You know, that's funny that, yes, because some people, they start a company and no matter what it is, they'll start a company or start in an adventure doing something, and they think, okay, well, it's just going to give it a couple of years and it'll blow up. No, you've got to put a lot of legwork in.
No, usually it's a 10-year, like I always tell people, get ready for a 10-year investment. The first 5 years, you're going to struggle. Year 5 through 10, you're going to see a little bit of daylight, but really it's around the 10th year with your company that you really going to start to, you should really start to see a difference. And that's, I would definitely say, about what it takes. I mean, it was the same thing before I did, real estate. My husband and I owned Subway restaurants, and we owned them for 11 years, and it was about the same. I mean, it was probably the first 5 years was really heavy and just white knuckle work and, you know, countless of hours that weren't paid. And then it really started turning around, and then, you know, around years 8 to 10, it was, you know, more of a very successful company that we were able to turn around and sell. So everything, I feel like you need to give yourself 10 years if you're gonna invest in something.
Yeah, because a lot of people think, even I know this from just doing the graphics part of the real estate industry back in the day, a lot of people before the boom and the fall, a lot of people assumed, you know, being a real estate agent, you can just walk in and just start making all kinds of money, that it's really easy, and it's not. People, and that's where a lot of the new ones, you'll see them, like, it's just like the gym in January. You'll be like, all these people are in the gym. You have all these people that are going to be successful real estate agents, and then by October, November, you still got the, you know, the pros that are still around, and the new guys have kind of dropped off.
That's what, you know, we hear a lot of that. Like, this market, for example, has taken a huge dive, right? The market has slowed way down. I think that they're saying that there is, I can't remember exactly what they said the quote was for underserved people right now, but basically, there's a lot more properties on the market than are selling. However, in our company, we've done almost double this year than what we did last year. And it's not because there's more stuff happening. It's just because we're demanding more of the market share. Because exactly, like the part-time agents, the people who just got in and tried to wing it while the market was so hot and people were just grabbing online realtors as fast as they could, they're all dying out because they're like, we haven't sold anything in 6 months or a year. Meanwhile, our most successful agents are closing 4 to 10 properties a month. And not because it's so readily available, but because they're good at their job and people trust them and they're hiring them as a professional.
Yeah, well, and because they're, well, because that's what's left. Yeah,
right.
I mean, you know, when you get all the newbies in and they can't handle it, like what you just said, the kind of same thing happened back in 07 and 08. You know, you had a lot of new agents, a lot of the people were running the tails, the jacket tails of the market that was rising. And then by the end of the year after it crashed, you know, we looked at advertisers and we looked at people that still were in the game, and it was the people that had been there for 10, 15 years, and it wasn't all of the new agents. And so when all the new agents kind of die out because they can't handle what it is or what they thought it was, you get left with the guys that had been doing it for a while. And, well, even now, like I'm on Google now, and it says, like, mortgage rates are rising. They keep rising because nobody can afford a house. They can barely buy groceries now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what they say, and it's more of a scare tactic, because at the end of the day, it's true, they can't buy as an expensive of a house because, let's face it, you only have so much money per month to work with, right? So if rates are high and that house is now $4,000 per month, where 2 years ago it was $2,000 per month, that means you can't afford that house, but you can afford a house that's half that price. Maybe that's what you need, and then when the rates go down, that house that you bought that's half that price is going to skyrocket, and now you're going to have a ton of equity to inject into the house that you really want. So it's all about how you're looking at it, but either way, I mean, if you can't afford to buy a house and you rent, you're paying somebody else's house. So what are you doing?
Yeah, like right now, it says North Carolina's housing market isn't even that competitive at the moment. Which is an election year, true.
In election years, we always had a dip of about 15%. But in everything is a big variance, right? Like, it depends on the market. So, like, North Carolina as a whole probably is down. You have some really rural areas of North Carolina. But, like, let's say Tennessee, for example. You cannot possibly compare, Memphis, for example, Memphis real estate with the inner city of Memphis to Franklin, Tennessee, right? Like, Franklin, Tennessee is multiple offers still. Like, I just did an offer in Middle Tennessee, and they had 5 offers on the property within 24 hours of making it accessible for people to come take a look at it and put offers in on it. And we were in a bidding war. So, absolutely, you got to look at each individual market for what it is. But if you look at real estate as a whole, it is absolutely down, for sure.
Yeah, and so you're saying these stuff, like what I'm looking at now, it's more of a, you can just run across and go, oh, okay, you can get a generalized idea that would be false. You would have to look at each individual, like what you just said. Well, you just made me think about something else. What do you think the hurricane damage in Tennessee or even North Carolina or something like that in general does to the housing market within that area? Like,
well, I can't speak specifically to that because I don't cover the areas that were affected directly. I mean, we cover some of the areas, but the areas that were most heavily hit, I can't speak to that directly, but what I can speak to is in the past when we've had some very bad tornadoes come through and, like, rip apart subdivisions and, like, demolish areas, it's actually sometimes it increases the real estate in other neighboring areas because what happens is the people make the insurance claims because their house is gone. So they have two options. They can either rebuild where their house was, or they need to buy another property. So a lot of times people, they either can't rebuild from where they were because there's just too much damage, or it's just too heartbreaking for them to rebuild where they were. So a lot of people will go to a neighboring area. When I say by neighboring areas, a lot of times when a town is affected, there are different areas of that town that weren't affected that people will go to. So it just depends on what the area is, what happened, but people need to go places to live. So a lot of times it just depends on their individual circumstances and what's going on with their property and their insurance and where they want to live and how they want to either rebuild or buy something different.
Yeah, I didn't know what you thought as far as a community perspective is, you know, what your thoughts on it were. Because, you know, real estate is very, it's very hyper local. It's not, a lot of real estate is done, but people don't realize this, most people kind of move just within their own county. It's not like all of your real estate transactions are people that move across the country. So real estate is very hyper-local. It's very, life dependent. You've got, you know, a single person that's going to get married, so they buy a house. Or you have somebody that has a third baby, so they need a bigger house. Or you have somebody that got divorced, so they need a smaller house. So a lot of real estate is focused around life changes. But I didn't know if, as a community perspective, and you being a real estate agent and kind of knowing that when something like that happens to a community or a town, you know, do you see the prices fall, or do you just kind of see it be a thing that there could be some positive out, you know, comes out of it? And I guess if they have to go to a neighboring city or go somewhere else that can help that other city, even though it's probably not, it sucks that it has to happen, because it was pretty devastating what happened in Tennessee and North Carolina. It's crazy.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But like I said, it's not, and I'm not exactly in those areas, so I can't say exactly for this, but like I said, in the past, when we've been in the areas where the tornadoes and stuff have hit, it's never wiped out an entire town. It's wiped out, sections, major sections. Like, we were in, I want to say it was maybe 2011 or 2012 when we had those five tornadoes that came through the Chattanooga region. I mean, wiped out neighborhoods, streets, and then there would be the neighborhood over that wasn't even touched. So it just, and yes, it actually did drive prices up, because you only have so many houses left, and you have more people now that need houses. So it's a temporary thing that happens, but it definitely does happen, and some people rebuild, and, you know, they clear up the land, they clean it back up, and they rebuild what was there. So it's such a variance that can happen, and it's devastating when natural disasters happen, absolutely devastating. But a lot of times communities pull together, and they rebuild, and they help each other out.
Now, back to raining, a couple of questions. What is your favorite part of the raining pattern?
It depends on the horse.
you know you're a true horse person when you say that right there.
Because what I love on one horse is definitely not what I love on a different horse. So I have a mare that is a massive stopper. That is my favorite thing in the world to do on her. I love stopping on her. I hate circling on her because she likes to swap leads on me. And so it makes me very tense, and I probably project it anyways. And so we have issues with that. And then I have a gelding that he spins like a champ. He is a plus spinner even on his bad days. Like, he just turns and spins like you wouldn't even believe. I love spinning on him. And then I've got this new little three-year-old that I am super excited about. I think she's going to have all the parts that I'm going to love, that I love on each one of my horses, but I love circling on her. When she does her circles, she just drops into it, and she just stretches out, relaxed, and she hunts her circles. And when you go to slow her up, it is the coolest feeling in the world. So, again, I'm hoping she puts all the parts on her that I love on the other horses, but I love all the parts of Raining. I just love them on different horses.
Well, you got a little bit of each, like the little bit of all of it in three different horses, which is kind of cool. But it's that's funny that you say that, because it's hard to find like an all around, like one that can do all of it perfect. I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I'm trying to say, like that you have, like you like all the parts of it, but you are right. Like some horses are just kind of better at certain things than other things. Yeah. So,
yeah.
It's amazing to see them spin like that. Like, I just think it's absolutely insane. Is there a right way? Do you have to go left or do you have to go right, or does it matter?
When you spin, you support the pattern? Yeah. So you spin left and right.
Oh! I didn't even know this, and I did showmanship and horses. Like, I showed horses, too, and I didn't even know this. So it is a part of the pattern. They tell you right or left.
Yeah, so you either go right or left first, but you always do both sets.
Mm-hmm. See, I'm a perfect example of how you always learn when it comes to horses.
Oh, always. Yeah, without a doubt. Especially when you're, like, talking to somebody who does a different discipline or a different breed. You can never know enough.
I know. I always think it's funny to see, like, you know, like back to what you just said in horse people. We are special, and it's not to degrade horse people in any way, shape, or form. But, you, like what you said, a horse people can call your bullshit really quick. Like you either know if you are being genuine or not being genuine. And I always think it's like, okay, well, why don't you just be honest? If you don't know, then you don't know. It's not that big of a deal. But on the contrary, on the flip side, you do meet some horse people that are just like, you know, if I ever see a horse trainer or a horse person acting like they know it all, that immediately tells me that they don't, like, right there.
That they're definitely, like, I find that, like, the greener you are, the more you act like you know everything. And what I've learned is the people who are more experienced, and the more experienced you are, the more you're like, I have no idea. Like, and that's what I always say. I'm like, God, like I said to somebody one time after a show, I'm like, I wish I knew what I didn't know, what I thought I knew when I first started riding, because I did so much better. Because at that point, like, you just didn't know what you didn't know, and you thought you knew everything. And then the longer you're in it, you're like, oh, my God, I don't do anything right.
That's how I felt. Like, when I grew up doing, like, Western Pleasure, and when I tried to, like, move into the cow horse world, this was when sorting first kind of started getting, like, exciting. This was 2013, 2014, I remember getting on her, and I wasn't arrogant in any way. I just thought, okay, well, I can ride. Like, I'm not an idiot here, okay? You know, I get on the horse, and I all of a sudden go into, like, pleasure brain mode, and he's looking at me like I've got eyes on my forehead, and I'm like, I'm doing it all wrong. He goes, yeah, that's not how you're supposed to ride her. And I'm like, okay. Alrighty, man. I don't know what I'm doing.
Yep, that's exactly, like, when I started doing Raining, I'm like, well, I grew up with horses. I'm, like, a fifth-generation horse rider. I'm like, I got this. They're like, you need to start in green. I'm like, I don't need to start in green. I'm, like, a non-pro. I think I ended up in green for 3 years. I'm like, oh, my God, I am in green. And, like, yeah, no, seriously, the longer you do it, the more you're like, okay, I learned something new every time I swing my leg over a horse.
Right, exactly. I like, that's like watching, I've always been like amazed with cutting horses. Obviously their agility and their like ability to do what they do is insane to me, just like reiners. But cutters, I've always kind of looked at them and go, okay, I would absolutely fall. I would fall. That horse would leave me in the dirt. There's no way.
Right.
I would try it though, for sure. But I think that makes anybody listening feel better, because, you know, I think it's true. Like, if you meet somebody that acts like they know it all when it comes to horses, no, that's a huge red flag.
No, they don't know anything. Like, I can tell by your knowledge level and your skill level by how much you act like you know everything.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, let me ask you this question. I know you said you wanted it to be, or you are going to actually have it be a national brand. That's your whole goal with Homes and Farms Realty, to have it everywhere. You've already gotten in 4 states, working on 2 more states. What's your next step as far as state-wise? Are you going to start moving towards Texas and Oklahoma and that area, or are you going to keep trying to take over? Because that'll be the southeast in general. Are you going to start going up north?
Yeah. So, yeah, I'd like to go north, too. So my next plan is Florida. I do have North Carolina in the scope. I do have Kentucky in the scope. And I am starting to look a little bit into West Virginia and New York and a little bit of Ohio. But I would love to get Texas. Texas is its own world. It's a totally different set of requirements than anywhere else in the country because Texas operates. Right? I mean, Texas just operates on its own beat. So in Texas, I would really like to get a broker on my team who's already a broker in Texas that can cover like the Weatherford, Pilot Point area. That's really the area like in northern Texas that I want to focus on. There is a girl that I absolutely love who, if she listens to this, she'll know who I'm talking about. But she's in Texas and she's a broker in Oklahoma. And I'm really hoping she joins my team because then we can open up a branch in there right away if she does. So
I had no I'm not surprised that Texas is on its own little thing as far as real estate is concerned, because it seems to be on its own little. I feel like Texas is that way. Probably California. I feel like California would be that way, too, and New York. I feel like they would probably. Yeah. I'm surprised Florida doesn't have its own set of. Like, I'm surprised you're not having to go through hoops and stuff with Florida, with it being different.
I am a little bit more. That's taking a little bit longer than I wanted to with Florida. They do have a couple of hoops, but not Texas. Texas is, like, literally its own little country. Like, they have their own completely separate operating rules that are not the same as anything else. So it's completely different to get licensed in there.
Very cool. Now, what is one thing that you would like to see improve in the industry, or something that you, aside from go ahead and separating yourself out from regular real estate all in general, what is something that you would like to see improved, particularly for horse farms within the real estate that you've kind of encountered, and something that you would like to see other people kind of do as well?
You mean as far as marketing or listing it, or what do you mean?
Well, I guess in general, you could pick whatever in general. If marketing is something that you would like to see improved, or a particular thing or listing or whatever have you, is there something within the industry that you wish people would do, or something that you think needs to be improved upon, whatever it is, marketing, listing, whatever?
Well, I would like to see people who go to buy or sell horse farms work with knowledgeable agents and not just list with their cousin or whoever. And a knowledgeable agent is going to be somebody that not just is in the horse world, but understands the cost that is behind duplicating something, or, the difference between European stalls versus somebody who just puts up stalls of 2x6 boards. Just really, really interviewing their agents so that they don't just hire an agent that comes in and is like, oh, I sell, 100 properties a year, but has nothing to do with horse farms. And then agents who are selling horse farms, I really wish that they would put the barns in to know that they're horse farms, and we don't have to go through 50 pictures to find out if they have a barn and an arena. And don't just put it in the description, but actually put the pictures up. They don't. They're just like, oh, there's stalls in here. Like, I've seen some stuff listed. There's a place in Middle Tennessee that's, like, listed at, like, $3 million, and the barn looks like Handyman Joe came in and put the stalls in. And I'm like, what? Like, what are they running with on this? So it's just, I don't know. It's definitely a pet peeve of mine, because barns are not created equal, just like houses are not created equal. Comes in and that's very experienced in selling houses, that's great, but you need somebody experienced in selling barns, because they're not created equal. So you need to understand that just because it's a 36 by 72 doesn't mean the same 36 by 72 is equivalent to a pole barn versus a barn that's built on a foundation with standing seam roof and, you know, hardy siding versus just metal everywhere.
Right, right, because the tax department's just going to look at it as an extra building.
And that's what we want them to look at it as, right? We don't want to be like, hey, tax assessor, this is a $1 million barn. We want to be like, tax assessor, this is not a $1 million barn. Like, we don't want to sell it to the tax assessor. But we do want to get it across to the people who put value in that, who understand, hey, this person who built this barn didn't just, you know, get a $50,000 pole barn, but they spent $500,000 in constructing a very well-crafted barn. It's the same size, but they're two different buildings, just like the difference in a house and having a house that's got 9-inch baseboard versus 2-inch baseboard, or got rolled out laminate floors versus imported hardwoods. I mean, all that stuff makes that square footage a different price variance.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. No, you're right. And then the market that it's, the location, there's so many factors that people don't understand that go into real estate, which is crazy because it's like, you know, you could go to the grocery store and buy bread and milk and apples, and you're not really worried about all this extra stuff, like as far as the general purpose, like you're generally purchasing something. You would think home purchasing would be easy, but it is so complicated. Like, when I was at my closing, I remember the stacks of papers were like an inch and a half thick. But, and that's intimidating because you're like, what does all this say?
Yes, it is literally, like, you literally sign for an hour. Like, people don't realize it. It's thick. But, yeah, it is intimidating, especially when it's something that's brand new to you or, you know, you've never done. And that's the same thing. Like, there's a place for new agents. There's a place for inexperienced agents. And usually that should be, like, on a team or with a mentor or something like that. But you get quite a difference when you hire somebody who's experienced. Because it's those little things, like knowing how to price something because of the different material or the different areas, or even just the neighboring, like every zip code is different. So just because you built it, like a multi-million dollar facility, doesn't mean that area is going to generate that kind of return for you. And then different areas can generate a larger return for you. So you got to know the market, which even when we come in from being outside of a market, like let's say we're going to sell something in Atlanta, right? Well, we know how to price it. So I don't have to live in Atlanta to go in and be like, this is what your horse farm is worth, because I know how to get the numbers that I need to get, which I'm going to get from anyways if I was hyper-local there. I'm able to pull the statistics. I'm able to piece it together. I usually put a spreadsheet together of all the different variances that are going to be on that property, and that number is usually way larger than what we actually are able to sell it for. And then going back through and looking at what the market will yield, and then coming up with a price point that will work for that particular property.
Are you familiar with Suwannee?
No.
Oh, it's about 15 minutes outside of Atlanta.
Okay.
I used to live there. That's why I
asked. Oh, yeah, no. I'm not familiar with all the little, like, the different communities in every area.
Oh, okay. Because, I mean, Atlanta is like a not, you don't have a lot of people that live actually in the city of Atlanta. That's more of commercial-based.
No.
So a lot of people live in, like, outskirt cities because I worked with a lot of agents in Atlanta. So, and that market has changed so much. But Suwannee was nice. It was really nice when I lived there. It's not anymore because I still talk to two people that live down there, but, yeah, that's cool. Well, you said you could do that. So I didn't know where Suwannee was.
But like example, that's like a perfect example. Like, I don't have to know where it is or what it was for me to be able to come in, take a look at your property, and then put it together as to what we could sell it for and pull all the numbers that I need to be able to pull and know that area that I'll need to study and know. Because it's the same thing, like when I list something that is, let's say if I list something like that's in my backyard versus something that's 300 miles from me, it's the same process, right? Like I have to still look at the facts. Like, you can feel like, well, I just know the facts because I'm here every day and I'm in it, right? But that's not really the facts. Like, that's your gut or your instinct saying, hey, I think it's this. And a lot of times you might think something is one way, but when you actually pull the numbers and look at it, like I get that a lot with sellers where they say, well, my neighbor sold for this price. And when I go and I look, they may have listed it for that price, but a lot of times it never even sold. They withdrew it, and they thought, well, it sold for that price. So you really need to get in, no matter if it's something that's really close to you or if it's far from you, and really look at what happened in the last 90 days, what happened in the last 6 months, what happened in the past year, what's changed, what's coming, is there anything new developing in the area, and look at it from all perspectives.
Yeah, which would probably be a good thing for you. If you're in these other states and stuff, you are probably recruiting agents that already live there, because that's going to be the better option versus having agents that kind of do it out of state to get the best service, I would think. But you're saying you don't need to do that.
No, not necessarily. It is not when it comes to horse properties. When it comes to listing, like, subdivision houses, yes, it's definitely better to have somebody that's going to be hyper-local, because they're going to know, like, the communities and stuff like that really well, the different sizes of the roads to live on, stuff like that, where they say, well, this side of the road is going to yield more, this side of the road may be in a different school district, which you can find online, but, like, little nuances like that. But when it comes to selling horse properties, they don't operate the same as subdivision or just normal community properties. They operate differently. And a lot of times when it comes to selling horse properties, especially your higher-end horse properties, you're not marketing to people to do a transit move, like within the community. You're marketing to horse people either also in the community, but nationwide or even internationally to come in to buy that unique property, because usually your horse properties that are more of your luxury properties are offering way more than what the neighbor is looking to buy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you're going to need somebody, for one, that has the money, two, that's already approved for it, and three, that's actually going to be doing horses. So that would be, so you're in the perfect spot as far as showing them to be around those people that are going to possibly be looking to do that. And then obviously probably social media is a good thing for you guys too, because you get to reach people that, you know, the horse world is so small. I think only 1.2 million people out of 334 million in the United States itself owns a horse. Which is very, that's like 0.6% of the population owns a horse.
Oh, yeah.
And so to be able to be on social media and reach that 0.6% of possible horse owners or people that already own horses, because, you know, it's hard to relocate a horse farm. Like, I've talked to a couple of people on here. One girl, she actually didn't relocate all those animals. She sold it, and then she moved it. And then another girl, we spoke to her, to move 10, 15 head of horses, it's crazy. Not only expensive, but to plan it and have to deal with it. She moved from Oregon to Oklahoma. And, Oregon to Oklahoma. It's a big ordeal. So do you guys have access to those type of amenities as far as haulers and people that are equipped and able to do all that kind of stuff?
Yep. I moved somebody from Washington to East Tennessee, just outside of Knoxville, Washington State. And,
oh, my
her
God.
Her husband was a retired NASA scientist, and they had a full facility that they had to relocate, and her horses were high-end hunter jumpers, so she only wanted them hauled in box stalls, and it was definitely a process. But a lot of the people, I relocated a family from Wyoming to Tennessee, also, and they had a whole herd of horses that they had to relocate. My most recent one is probably Connecticut to Tennessee. And, it's definitely a process. Most people want to bring their horses with them.
It's 35 hours. Google says it's 35 hours to drive from Washington State to Tennessee, and that's not even – it's not East Tennessee, but still, okay.
Yeah, it's probably West Tennessee, but it's not something that's done lightly. It's there's layovers, there's all kinds, it's a massive move, and yes, it does cost an extensive amount of money. So you have to look at, is it worth it? Do I want to, or do I want to sell and then repurchase different ones when I get here? And that's just you know, a personal decision. Some of these horses mm-hmm. are priceless to their owners. So, it's again, it's just, it's such a variance per person.
Oh, yeah. No, I would have to be, I would be the person that's be like, all right, how much is it going to cost for a hauler to haul, you know, X amount of horses from here to here? That's crazy. Well, that's good that you guys are there throughout the entire process. You know, some agents aren't there through the whole process. So that's really cool that you guys are there to help with that type of stuff.
Oh, yeah. We definitely help and guide and understand. I mean, we get people that are moving from all over the place. So they don't understand, like, how the climate is or how the ground is, stuff like that, that we can help guide them with when picking a horse farm, too.
I can't believe that. That's 35 hours. What did you say the other one was? Connecticut? From Tennessee to Connecticut?
Yeah. And that's even not as far. I've had people from Wyoming.
That's 15 hours.
Jesus Christ. Yeah.